Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Which has done the most to shape the world's history? Humans or germs? Did Homo sapiens get the better of the Neanderthals because of superior brain power, as we've been told so often, or because of resistance to some infectious disease? Are germs part of the story behind the fall of Rome and the rise of Islam? Well, Jonathan Kennedy thinks the more you look at germs, the more important they seem. He teaches politics and global health at Queen Mary University, London, and he has a PhD in sociology from Cambridge. So welcome to you.
Thank you. Good morning, Owen.
Good morning. And, well, you know, Victorians wrote about the great men and Marx wrote about dialectical materialism, but you think germs explain a lot of history.
Yeah, exactly. I think we can even take a step backwards. And if we go to the 1600s and Delft in the Netherlands, there was a Dutch haberdasher who developed lenses to start to look at the cloth that he was buying and selling. And after a while, he obviously got restless and began to look at the natural world. And he was the first person to really gaze upon the world of microbes. And this is a world that's on the one hand, so tiny, we can't see it with our eyes, but also so vast that the numbers are just absolutely, absolutely mind-blowing. And I like to think of it as, you know, probably Antony van Leeuwenhoek has come the closest to anyone in the world, really, to stepping through the looking glass or falling down a rabbit hole and waking up in a strange world of fantastical creatures. And so a couple of years ago, myself, as a non-scientist, as someone with a background in the social sciences and an interest in history, started to read a bit about viruses and bacteria. And it really blew my mind. And there's a few kind of little snippets of research that I can discuss that really capture this wonderment. And one is the fact that, I mean, just the numbers are mind-blowing. If we were to take all the bacteria on our planet and weigh them, their mass would be over 1,000 times that of all the humans. Viruses, which are even smaller, if you added all of the viruses on our planet end to end, they would reach for 100 million light years. But it's not just the numbers of microbes that are really hard to get one's head around. It's also the impact that they've had on us, on humans, in part as individuals. And so certainly one of the studies that really got me thinking about this was the studies that look at the impact of retroviruses on our evolution. So retroviruses are a special kind of virus that reproduce by inserting their DNA into our human genome. If they manage to infect our reproductive cells, so either our eggs or our sperm cells, then these genes, this DNA, this virus DNA, is passed on from generation to generation. So we've managed to acquire a number of capabilities or functions that we think of as being really fundamentally human from these kind of virus infections. And it sounds like it can't possibly be true, but even functions like memory formation or the ability to give birth, these are in large part due to viral infections that happened hundreds of millions of years ago.
You say there that memory formation, for example, may have been partly a consequence of being infected with bacteria or viruses. But I guess that all that is saying is that germs have played a big role in human evolution, right? Which, I mean, tell us about that. How big a role have they played in human evolution?
Well, absolutely critical, really, if we think that all complex life evolved from single-celled organisms that were either bacteria or pretty much like bacteria. And the first complex cells emerged when two of these single cells came together and started living in a symbiotic union, which is why, for example, mitochondrial DNA is different to the DNA in our cell nucleus. But as I was saying, 8% of our DNA comes from these retrovirus infections, and they've allowed us to develop the ability to perform all sorts of functions that we think of as fundamentally human. But even today, the bacteria in our body are influencing things like our moods, which kind of fundamentally questions the nature of what it is to be human. And I guess this was the starting point for my book and for my thesis, really. The idea that if microbes have played such a vital role in our individual bodies, what role do they play when we look at aggregations of bodies, when we look at society, when we look at the body politic, the body social, and the body economic?
Yeah, because that seems to be different, doesn't it? Because, I mean, you know, it's one thing to say, I mean, I think you've got a figure in the book that germs basically account for 30% of the genetic mutations that make the difference between chimps and us.
When we think about this, it fundamentally alters the way that we understand evolution. If we think of certainly the Darwinian idea of evolution by natural selection, there's this idea that you have this big struggle between various species and within various species, and the biggest, the strongest, the smartest survive. And this is the driving force of history. Nature is red in tooth and claw, as Alfred Lord Tennyson said, and there's this kind of brutal competition going on between species and within species. So it's very similar. And actually, it's really interesting because, you know, kind of the economics of Adam Smith had a big influence on Charles Darwin. And we can almost see that this theory of evolution is basically, you know, kind of classical economics as applied to the natural world. But when we actually look at the nature of evolution, and when scientists have done this over the last few decades, we see that it's not so simple. And where there is competition, often it's not, you know, within species, and it's not competition with kind of apex predators. The biggest driver of evolution is infectious diseases. Therefore, one of the biggest factors that allows people to survive and pass on their genes is the ability to survive infectious diseases and pandemics. And so, yeah, as we say, I think there was a study a while ago that showed something like that about a third of cells in the body were selected for because of viral infections.
Exactly. So it seems to me, as you sort of touched on, we've got two things going on here. There's the effect of infectious disease on individuals, and then if you aggregate it, it's a different story, because then the idea that humans have put on when writing history, basically, that humans are at the centre of that, and whether it's great men or class clashes or whatever sort of history you prefer, all of that slightly takes a back seat to your version of history, which is that infectious diseases have driven a lot of events that historians hitherto have basically ascribed to human agency.
Yeah, no, exactly. I think, you know, the way that most people view history and most people view the interaction between humans and the natural world is kind of similar to the way that we envisaged it back in the days of the Old Testament. You know, this idea that in Genesis, God created humans in his own image and then gave us dominion over the natural world. But the more we learn about the natural world, we realize that it's not some kind of stage where either great men and women or classes play out their roles. We need to conceptualize the world, the natural world, as a system. And humans are a relatively small part of this system. And microbes and infectious diseases in particular play an enormous role. And as you said in the introduction, in everything from the extinction of Neanderthals 50,000 years ago to the emergence of Christianity in the first millennium, or the transition from feudalism to capitalism 1,000 years later.
Yeah, well, we'll talk through some of those precise examples because they're very, very interesting. But just before we go through some of these historical events, to what extent has, you know, recent capabilities to research DNA helped you understand all this?
It's absolutely revolutionized the way that we understand prehistoric pandemics and the role of infectious diseases in prehistory. Up until about 10 years ago, we knew very, very little about what was going on with regards to the infectious diseases, anything more than about 2,500 years ago when the ancient Greeks first started writing history. But the massive advances in the ability to both extract and analyze DNA from really ancient skeletons has transformed our understanding of the past in general. And there's a variety of examples I could give. I think, you know, one of the really interesting ones is if we look at Western Sweden, there's a tomb with about 70 bodies dating to 5,000 years ago. And back then, this would have been a really kind of sparsely populated part of Northern Europe. And so having so many people die around the same time is really extraordinary. And a couple of years ago, scientists looked at the genetic material they'd extracted from the dental pulp of a couple of these skeletons. And they realized that there wasn't just human DNA there. There was also the DNA of the microbes that were swimming around in their blood at the time of their death. And they managed to identify the oldest known specimen of Yersinia pestis, so the bacteria that causes plague. And this is fascinating in and of itself, right? That we can pretty accurately diagnose what people died of 5,000 years ago. But I think what's really fascinating is when we start to piece this particular bit of evidence together with other clues from the Neolithic age. And we can, for example, look at the fact that there are other slightly later examples of Yersinia pestis that have been found more or less across the whole of Eurasia, or at least as far as the Altai Mountains in Siberia. We also know in Europe at the time that the population, it collapsed about 5,000 years ago. Since the adoption of farming, it had been increasing and increasing, and then it fell by about 50 or 60%. And so if we put these two bits of information together, it certainly indicates that there was some kind of Neolithic Black Death around this time, and it decimated the farming communities of Europe, including actually the people who built Stonehenge. And then we also have a pretty good idea from studies of ancient DNA what happened afterwards. There appears to have been a massive migration of people from basically the Western Eurasian steppe, somewhere around the north of the Black Sea, a relatively small group of nomadic shepherds migrated westwards, reaching the British Isles, and they brought both their genetic material with them, but also they appear to be the origins of Indo-European languages. Even today, these so-called Western steppe herders account for something like 40% of the genetic material for people who originate from Northern Europe.
There's lots of sort of fascinating things about this, but I mean, the bit that seems so interesting to me is that I can imagine that people writing about that movement of from north of the Black Sea into Europe and the impact it's made would normally have assumed it was military conquest or maybe trade routes and all these sort of other explanations people have for the movement of people. But you've basically just given a, you know, really convincing argument that, in fact, it was disease.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's pretty hard to understand what happened otherwise, because you had a well-established farming community. The European continent was pretty densely populated, and it's really hard to imagine otherwise how you would have such a dramatic turnover in population in such a short period of time. In the British Isles, you have about 4,500 years ago, the genetic identity of the population is predominantly these early European farmers who came from what's now Turkey, and then you have a more or less total replacement of population within 100 years or so. And so it's really hard to understand what happened without the impact of infectious diseases. And I think this is a common thread throughout Pathogenesis, the book, the fact that often there's these really miraculous events that happen in history, and they're kind of hard to explain unless you refer to the role of infectious diseases.
So let's go through in a bit more detail the example we've both mentioned once, the Homo sapiens and Neanderthal, which I think I'm right in saying that, you know, the traditional account is that Homo sapiens basically outthought the Neanderthals. But why is infectious disease part of that story, and how did it happen? I mean, what can you tell us about what actually happened?
Certainly the dominant explanation is that Homo sapiens were more intelligent, and that we were basically, because of this, able to outcompete Neanderthals. But there's been a variety of recent research that has demonstrated that Neanderthals were capable of all sorts of sophisticated behaviors. And we've got to the point now where, you know, the gap between Homo sapiens on the one hand and Neanderthals on the other in terms of behavior is absolutely tiny. For example, Neanderthals were or seem to have been able to sail between islands in the Eastern Mediterranean. They certainly knew how to use fire. They painted kind of basic images onto cave walls. They also appear to have used various medicinal plants to treat maladies. So this explanation that Homo sapiens, which of course means wise man or wise humans, were more intelligent than Neanderthals, who, like, certainly in the 100 years ago, there were people who were calling Neanderthals Homo stupidus. This kind of Homo sapiens, Homo stupidus dichotomy is no longer viable. So this raises the question, what actually happened? We should remember that Neanderthals were also bigger, stronger, and heavier than Homo sapiens. So this adds to the mystery. And the most convincing explanation is infectious diseases. So, you know, for at least 500,000 years, Homo sapiens were living in Africa and Neanderthals were living in Western Eurasia. They occupied a pretty large region all the way from kind of Gibraltar in the west to the Altai Mountains again in Siberia. We were evolving in different parts of the world with different climates and also different disease environments. And certainly there's no evidence that we interacted for hundreds of thousands of years. But then maybe about 150,000 or 120,000 years ago, we have evidence that humans began to interact with Neanderthals. We were pushing out of Africa into the Levant, and Neanderthals were pushing down from Western Eurasia. And we know that the two species of human met, because we humans, at least people whose ancestors grew up in Europe, in Asia, or Native Americans, have somewhere between 2% and 4% Neanderthal DNA. And this comes from these liaisons that occurred 100,000, 60,000 years ago. And I think the really important thing to remember is that these genes that we've inherited from Neanderthals, they're not random. We retain certain gene variants because they gave us an advantage as we pushed out of tropical Africa and into more temperate Eurasia, where there was a different disease environment. And we also have to think, what would happen when we first met? Clearly, species had sex and reproduced, but also we would have exchanged infectious diseases that were probably had a pretty insignificant impact on the species that were carrying them because they'd evolved to deal with them. But the other species meeting these pathogens for the first time would have been absolutely devastated. So we see that for almost 100,000 years, the Eastern Mediterranean region seems to have been almost like a no-go area for Neanderthals and Homo sapiens. They would try to push out of their regions into the Eastern Mediterranean, and then it seems like they would reproduce sometimes, but they would also get sick and die.
But I mean, presumably, that, you know, the DNA evidence shows that they had sex and they reproduced, but the disease could have been not necessarily sexually transmitted. It could have been, you know, through aerosol, you know, or some other means of transmission.
No, exactly. And I think what's really fascinating is scientists have looked at the genes that we've retained, and it seems to be that we were encountering various Neanderthal viruses that are pretty similar to modern flu and modern HIV/AIDS. I guess the kind of to fast forward to what happened was that because Homo sapiens had evolved in tropical Africa, this was a part of the world that gets much more of the sun's energy. So there's more vegetation, there's more animal life, and there's more microbes. So we would have carried more and more deadly pathogens as we pushed out. So it would have taken the Neanderthals longer to overcome our diseases. So we were able to push out of Africa without getting sick, whereas the Neanderthals were still getting horribly sick. And this provided us with a massive advantage in this struggle for existence.
Gosh, well, I mean, that has a parallel with today, because, I mean, often, you know, it's quite a controversial topic, but illnesses such as Ebola and I think even HIV, didn't people say that originated in Africa? So you're saying that happened way back as well?
Yeah, and it makes perfect sense from there's a very clear epidemiological pattern that the closer one gets to the equator, the more microbes and the more pathogens there tend to be.
I see. Yeah. So there's just a hard fact about where people have had to become most resistant to disease.
Exactly.
Yeah. So okay. Well, that deals with that fascinating story. And then as you go through your book, you describe other moments where germs have an infectious disease have played a big role. Can you talk us through some of these other bodies that have been found? Because you talk about that group in, was it northern Sweden? But you also talk about Cheddar Man and Otzi the Iceman. What did they tell us?
Even before we start talking about infectious diseases, there's some really delicious ironies when we start looking at ancient DNA. And first of all, you mentioned Cheddar Man, and it's a particular interest of mine because I grew up in Somerset, and still today when I go to my parents, one of my favourite bike rides is to go across the levels and up Cheddar Gorge. But about 100 odd years ago, 120 years ago, some people who were digging a drainage trench in a cave in Cheddar Gorge found Cheddar Man, and Cheddar Man is the oldest, almost complete skeleton ever to be found in the British Isles. So about 9,000 years old. Therefore, he's known to be the first Briton. And again, a couple of years ago, researchers from the Natural History Museum managed to extract some DNA and to work out what Cheddar Man would have looked like. And I think to most people's surprise, he had really quite dark skin, dark hair, and blue eyes. So I think particularly at a time when there was all this discussion about the problems that supposedly immigrants were causing in the UK, and there were politicians on the right who were kind of advocating for the rights of indigenous Britons, I think it was kind of a nice irony that the first Briton was so kind of different physically from what we think of as an English rose. And Cheddar Man would have been a hunter-gatherer. his descendants disappeared about 6,000 years ago at the same time as we see a new influx of people who would have been kind of olive-skinned, brown-eyed, who moved across Europe from Anatolia, so modern-day Turkey, and brought farming with them. And I think there's a pretty good argument for the fact that they would have been aided in their journey by infectious diseases. Infectious diseases really kind of multiplied, and we entered the modern age of infectious diseases when humans transitioned from hunting and gathering to farming, because for the first time, humans were living cheek by jowl, not just with other humans, but also with animals of various types. So both the animals that they domesticated, but also a variety of parasites that lived on the grain that they gathered and stored. And so this provided the perfect environment for pathogens to jump from one species to another. And then living in kind of densely populated settlements provided many more opportunities for these pathogens to be transmitted from person to person, either by infected water or through the air. And so this provided farming populations with a kind of unwitting secret weapon as they moved through Europe and through other parts of Eurasia, that kind of, you know, wiped out the pre-existing hunter-gathering populations and cleared the way for this farming population. And so these first farmers would have been very similar to Ötzi the Iceman, the 5,000, 6,000 year old mummified remains of which were found in the Alps on the Italian-Austrian border.
In those two cases, then, you're sort of speculating as to what the history might have been. You're not finding evidence, or evidence hasn't been found in those skeletons to indicate, rather like that northern Swedish group, you know, that you could actually diagnose something.
No, so nothing in Cheddar Man, but Ötzi the Iceman, he was very clearly a farmer, and there's a few clues to that. One, he was wearing goatskin and sheepskin clothes and shoes, but he was also had lots of parasites in his gut. He was infected by lice, and the fact that he had a kind of many more parasites living on and in him suggests that he came from a population that had gone through the agricultural revolution.
So this may be the subject of another book, I guess, but I'll ask you the question just if you know anything about it. But if you say that humans, when they gathered in villages and towns and cities, were more prone to disease, so basically infectious disease became a bigger factor in human development, can you tell parallel stories about animals? I mean, are there animals that, you know, flocks and herds and that sort of thing, and therefore their development is affected by infectious disease?
No, definitely. And I think, you know, this is a big part of the story of world history, the fact that there were a large array of animals in Eurasia that lived in enormous herds. So if we think of the kind of wild pre-agricultural revolution, cows and horses, and they lived in the wild in vast herds, and this provided opportunities for infectious diseases to emerge and to kind of become endemic in these populations. And this is why, for example, Europeans, or the Spanish conquistadors in particular, carried a much bigger disease load when they crossed the Atlantic and they started interacting with Native Americans, because, you know, kind of the Inca certainly and the Aztecs, the Mexica, were pretty advanced civilizations, but in the Americas you didn't have this vast array of herd animals that allowed a large number of pathogens to pass from animals to humans. The only kind of real herd animals that you have in the Americas are llamas and alpacas, and even they live in pretty small herds in the wild.
Well, you've taken our story far forward, so let's just deal with that period, but we'll have to go back to ancient Greece and things in a minute. But when you're talking about, you know, the impact that people had in the Americas, in Australia, on indigenous populations, which was very, very marked, talk us through, first of all, how big that impact was, because that is a modern example of what you're talking about.
Yeah, so I think the classic explanation and the one that I engage with and critique a little bit in the book is that of Jared Diamond and guns, germs, and steel. And so Diamond argues that basically Europeans managed to conquer other parts of the world because we had better technology, but also we were helped along by our germs. And I think kind of when you actually read Diamond's book, he says that the technological advantages that Europeans had in the Americas were so big that we would have conquered the continent anyway. But I think we have to realize that actually it's really hard to conquer a foreign country that doesn't want you there, or a foreign community that doesn't want you there. It's really hard to cross an ocean and go and kind of impose yourself upon another society. And we've seen that, you know, in the last 20 years with what's happened in Afghanistan. The Americans and their allies had pretty modest aims to kind of change the regime, and they threw enormous amounts of resources at the problem as they saw it. You know, over 100,000 troops at the height, trillions of dollars spent, the kind of most advanced arms ever used in warfare against, you know, what was essentially a pretty ragtag group of religiously enthused insurgents. And, you know, they were no better off after 20 years than they were at the beginning. And so when we think about this, it really shows us how astounding the Spanish conquest of the Americas was. So, you know, you get kind of Hernan Cortes in the early 1520s going over to Mesoamerica and conquering this vast civilization. Tenochtitlan was the capital, and it was four times as big as the biggest city in Spain at the time, Seville, to give you an idea of how much more advanced it was than Spain. You know, the only reason that this was possible, the only reason that Cortes was able to conquer this vast empire with about 1,000 men was because the Mexica, the Aztec, were absolutely devastated by the pathogens that Cortes and his men brought across. So first of all, you see smallpox devastating the population, and then after that you have pandemic after pandemic that you know killed enormous numbers of Native Americans but didn't touch the Europeans. And you know, there's been some estimates. The best estimate for how many people died is something like 55 million people. So the population dropped from about 60 million at the beginning of the 16th century to 6 million at the end. So this is about a 90% fall in the population. And it was so big that it led to the world's average temperatures dropping, and it contributed to the coldest years of the Little Ice Age, when, of course, the Thames froze over and things like this. And then the conquest of the Inca was even more remarkable 10 years later, when Francisco Pizarro went to this kind of this vast South American empire with 168 men and managed to conquer it. And, you know, historically, people have explained it as being the superiority of Europeans, maybe their technology, maybe their gods. But, you know, it's absolutely preposterous that this could have happened without infectious diseases.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% 50% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Right, so your difference with Jared Diamond is more one of emphasis, you know, the extent of the role of technology and the extent of the role of infectious diseases.
Well, I guess whereas Diamond would say guns, germs, and steel, I'd probably say germs, germs, germs. So that
that's a bit of technology thrown in as well, probably. Okay, but then it's striking that which way this goes. So you're talking about the Europeans going to the Americas and infecting people who are living there, and earlier you had people coming from Africa and affecting the Neanderthals. Now, I mean, presumably it could have worked the other way. You know, it could have been that the Europeans were susceptible to some disease that the Americans were had resistance to, or do you have explanations as to why it tends to go in a particular direction?
The main reason is just that there were by chance more species of animals in Eurasia that lived together in big herds and created opportunities for infectious diseases to emerge and to become endemic in those species. So we're thinking of cows and sheep and goats and horses. And then when these animals were domesticated, these pathogens jumped over from animals to humans. And at first they would have been devastating for the early farmers, but with time, our immune systems developed defenses and these diseases became endemic in our population as well. Whereas you also saw agricultural revolutions in the Americas, but you don't have so many wild animals that were domesticated, and certainly not herd animals.
So I guess what's convincing about that is that it happened in Canada, it happened in Australia, it happened in North America, South America. So that there were quite a few places where a similar process happened.
Exactly. Again, this was an unwitting secret weapon that the Europeans carried with them. But I think it's also interesting to think about the psychological impact that this would have had on the Native Americans, because, of course, this was centuries before germ theory, and this must have just seemed like the conquering population had better gods. And so I think this can maybe explain the fervor with which the American populations adopted Christianity and the continued kind of impact of the Catholic Church in this region.
So I just want to, before we spool back to the ancient Greeks, I just want to ask you about COVID and whether let's just for argument's sake say that this didn't come from the lab in Wuhan, which many people think it did, but actually came from a wet market in Wuhan, and somehow there was a transmission from animals to humans in Wuhan, and then COVID spread around the world. Would that be a sort of reverse process where, if you like, less developed culture that had this very close contact in these wet markets compared to Europeans who are now sort of far removed from nature?
Yeah, I mean, I think we have to be careful of thinking about more and less developed, but certainly we're at the moment where I think we like to think that we've conquered infectious diseases and that vaccines and antibiotics have kind of helped make kind of pandemics a thing of the past, and that maybe COVID was an aberration. But I think actually, you know, when we take a step back, you see that we're living in a new golden age of microbes, basically, because the unprecedented population growth we've had in the last century, the incredible density of population, the encroachment on animal habitats, the increased intensity of farming, not to mention kind of the speed at which we can now travel around the world. This has created kind of perfect conditions for new pathogens to not just emerge but also spread. So it's kind of like a souped up version of what happened during the adoption of agriculture, really.
Yeah, but what I'm wondering is whether in let's say in the United States today, Western Europe, you know, growing vegetarianism, people living in cities but with very much pre-packaged food and not getting out into nature at all and not seeing, you know, rarely even visiting the countryside in many cases, would that make those people actually more susceptible to disease? So it's almost coming out the other end of it.
Yeah, no, I guess there's some truth in that. Yeah, but I mean, I guess it goes two ways. So part of the, you know, on the one hand, they're removed from interactions with animals, but living in a city and, you know, traveling around by tube and sitting in crowded offices can also expose you to pathogens. So I guess it goes both ways, but certainly there's more opportunities for pathogens to jump species in other parts of the world.
Yeah, in places where that contact is greater. Well, okay, and now, as advertised, the ancient Greeks. Now, what seems interesting about that is that you know, previously were telling the story from DNA evidence and population movements and so on, but when you get onto the ancient Greeks, you start getting other evidence, written evidence, that can back up some of your claims, as it were, isn't it, and ideas about what actually happened in various moments of history.
I think it's really important that, you know, if we look at Greek literary sources, we see that epidemics, pandemics play a really, really important role, whether it's Homer's Iliad or Thucydides' The History of the Peloponnese War, or even Sophocles' Oedipus Rex. Infectious disease outbreaks play a really, really important role. And so let's focus on Thucydides and the history of the Peloponnesian War. This is one of the first historical accounts. And Thucydides argues that a outbreak of what he calls plague, which was possibly smallpox, which occurred in Athens at the beginning of the Peloponnesian War, played a really, really important role in the outcome of the conflict. So it not just killed a third of the population of Athens, it also killed Pericles, the great statesman and general. And he says nothing did so much as to weaken the Athenians. And of course, it was another two decades until they lost to Sparta, but this really set Athens on the path to defeat. And this had really kind of a profound impact on history. If we think of Athens in the middle of the 5th century BCE, this was, you know, a time of cultural, political, intellectual flourishing that has few parallels in history. It was the time of Herodotus and Thucydides. It was the time of Sophocles, the time of Socrates and Hippocrates and Pericles. It was the age when Athenians went to the Pnyx, the hill by the Acropolis, and every week they would discuss the really important issues of the day and vote on them. It was the time in ancient Greek civilization when the Parthenon was built, that still looms over the city. And so the loss in the Peloponnesian War to Sparta, which was a militaristic, oligarchic city-state, really kind of ended this flourishing almost as soon as it had started. And, you know, kind of counterfactuals or what ifs in history are often a little bit of a fool's errand, but we can start to wonder what might have happened if the plague of Athens hadn't come along and handed victory to the Spartans.
Yeah, and then another moment where disease played a very big role was in the medieval period. We're spooling forward now, and the plague and the Black Death and all that.
Yeah, so I think we all know that the Black Death was catastrophic. This was caused again by Yersinia pestis, but I think quite often we don't appreciate how devastating it was and also how big an impact it had on society. So, you know, the Black Death killed over half, maybe 60% of the population of Europe. And, you know, this is bad enough, but plague came back again and again over the next two centuries. So there was the second plague in 1361 that killed perhaps 30% of the population. And the English population didn't recover until the 1700s. And this demographic shock, this collapse in population, had an enormous impact on society. Obviously, the Black Death in the middle of the 14th century occurred during the High Middle Ages, when Western Europe was dominated by a feudal system. And a feudal system tends towards stagnation because there's no real motivation for anyone to maximize what they produce, to adopt kind of technology. For the feudal lords, because it's an unstable situation where everyone has private armies, you want to spend all the surplus resources you have on either building castles or strengthening your army or shoring up support. Because if you don't do that, if you go and spend all your money on windmills to improve agricultural output, someone else will just come along with their army and take your land. And similarly for peasants, for the serfs at the bottom of the system, their main priority was not to starve. So that's why you have this strip system where the serfs would grow different crops in different parts of their lord's estate, because that would minimize the risk that adverse weather or disease or wild animals would destroy their whole crop and lead to disaster. So this is why you see kind of very little improvement in living conditions from the Roman period. But this all changes with the Black Death, because all of a sudden the serfs see that land is plentiful. There's half the number of serfs that there were a couple of years before, and they realize that their labor is scarce and in demand. And this kind of leads to a struggle that plays out over decades, that leads to that explodes into the open during the 1381 peasants revolt. And the feudal lords are really trying hard to maintain the feudal system because it works for them, but eventually they have to give in. They can't hold back the kind of demographic tide any longer. And so about 100 years after the Black Death, basically you have kind of all the serfs in England have been freed, have won their freedom. And eventually you see the emergence of a kind of agricultural capitalism. So the lords kind of maintain control of their land, but they rent it out at market rates to the most entrepreneurial of the former serfs. And this means that the vast majority of the rural population no longer have access to their land, but those entrepreneurial yeoman farmers, this new commercial class, really start to adopt technology. So they bring in draft animals and plows, and they specialize in producing particular crops that are suited to the areas in which they live. And you see this massive boom in agricultural output that can not just feed the growing cities, but also food becomes so cheap in England that workers have money for the first time to spend on things like textiles and sugar and tobacco. So this transformation in the English countryside also drives the emergence of industrialization and colonialism.
One thing you said there just prompted a question that occurs to me, which is, I think there's an assumption in evolution, maybe just in sort of popular science, but nonetheless, there's this idea that as the human species has evolved, it's got cleverer and it's got, you know, maybe fitter and more agile, and, you know, it's got more refined and better in some way. But when you describe these mass diseases, they're not distinguishing between people who have got particularly good capabilities. They're pretty random, right? And it can be Pericles can get it just as much as the next person. So there isn't, yeah. You know, what you're suggesting is that evolution isn't quite producing the. It's not selection of the fittest and the best. It's just selection of the most disease resistant.
Exactly. Yeah. So we see that, you know, some of the gene variants that allow people to survive massive pandemics are ones that kind of don't actually confer greater strength or anything like that. In many ways, or in many instances, it's often these genes actually often kind of have negative consequences on the functioning of the body more generally. So we have this weird situation where, you know, the immune system is better because it can withstand the disease, but actually it creates other problems. And I guess the classic example for this is something like sickle cell disease, right? So, sorry, sickle cell anemia, which, you know, changes the shape of the red blood cells and provides people whose ancestors lived in malarial areas with a evolutionary advantage because the plasmodium can't reproduce in their bodies, but it also creates other massive health complications that lead to kind of really, really painful problems.
I want to ask about the future now, and one area that would be interesting to think about is biological weapons, because you know what you've described is the power of infectious disease, but also the slightly random nature of who gets affected by it, which is, I guess, what we've seen with COVID. I mean, you know, who knows whether it was a biological weapon in the making or not, but you know, if it was, then it hasn't been particularly effective because it's affected the everyone rather randomly. It and it's not very precise.
No, exactly. And I think there's a few points to bring up about this issue. I think first of all, something that's really striking is that, you know, certainly for the first year until effective and safe vaccines were developed, we were using the same kind of policies to deal with the spread of infectious diseases as we were using hundreds of years ago to deal with the spread of the plague. So, you know, kind of lockdowns and zero COVID policies were pretty similar to the kind of quarantines that were used by Venice in the 1400s, even, or the cordon sanitaires that were used by the Austro-Hungarian Empire in the 1700s. So we are as a species still, you know, particularly and worryingly vulnerable to infectious diseases, which is what makes kind of the use of viruses as a biological weapon so concerning. But as you point out, the one issue for that is that they, you know, kind of COVID has been so undiscriminating that it's caused, you know, kind of death and devastation across the world. I guess the way around that would be to develop both a kind of biological weapon, but also a vaccine, so you can vaccinate your own population. But yeah, pretty worrying stuff.
Yeah, let's talk about vaccines then, because if you're basically saying, as you are, that infectious disease has been a major driver of historical events, then can we say we're in for a more stable period of historical events, because it seems that we've got the ingenuity now to develop vaccines, and you know, COVID would have had a far bigger impact if it hadn't been for the vaccines. And we, you know, we have a largely stable situation. Of course, a lot of people have suffered and died, but in terms of moving history, it hasn't really, which it might have done without the vaccines.
Yeah, I think, you know, we'll have to wait and see what impact COVID-19 has had on history. I mean, I think if we look at instances from the past, we see that, you know, kind of infectious disease outbreaks, they often interact with other phenomena and other processes that were already ongoing at the time of the pandemic. So climate change and technological advances, for example. And, you know, I think we could certainly make an argument that, you know, COVID-19 has perhaps changed the world in several ways. And I think possibly the biggest way might be the way that we view the world. So first of all, you know, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, academics could say with a serious face that we'd reached the end of history, that liberal democracy was the only reasonable way to organize our politics, and capitalism was the only sensible way to organize economies. And I think kind of, you know, if we look at certainly the examples of the UK, where, you know, Boris Johnson and the Tories were pretty irresponsible with just trying to slow the spread. You know, if we look at the US, where Donald Trump just let the disease rip, we really see the limitations of this kind of liberal approach where personal freedom is placed above anything else in the priorities of politicians. And you know, certainly I wouldn't want to look at somewhere like China as an example to follow, but countries like New Zealand or Australia that took a much more kind of strict approach, that did impose limitations on freedom, also had kind of a much better public health outcomes. And you know, we can kind of downplay the impact of COVID, but it still killed an estimated 15 million people. It threw the economy into absolute chaos for several years. And you know, we're still dealing with the fallout of that, certainly in the UK, right? With kind of inflation levels that haven't been seen since the 1970s, and the kind of difficulties that causes for people. So yeah, I think we still have to wait and see as to the impact of COVID and how transformative it actually is. And I guess the other point is that it might not just be COVID, right? We're living in an age where infectious diseases can easily jump between from one species to humans and then can spread and cause devastation. And so it might be avian flu, for example, that causes another devastating outbreak in a year's time or several years' time. And you know, we're dealing with the cumulative effect of these outbreaks. So I think hopefully COVID was an aberration, but the kind of skeptical side of me and my kind of understanding of public health suggests that it might well not be a one-off, unfortunately.
Yeah, but it's interesting, you mentioned the politics there making a difference to how it's handled, and that's obviously right. But yeah, that sort of rather took me back to your comments on South America and infectious disease being much more important than technological advantage. And I'd have thought that as we look ahead, issues such as vaccines, microbial resistance, you know, all these issues relating to the spread of infectious diseases will be more important than than the politics.
Well, I think we have to remember that the politics and the technology can't be divorced from one another. So just to take another example, if we look at who was affected by COVID in the UK or the US, it wasn't kind of equal across social classes or even kind of ethnic groups. It tended to be the case in the UK and US that people in poorer areas of the countries were much worse affected, and also certain minoritized groups were affected much worse than others. And so again, in a way, and it was, I think, Richard Horton, the editor of the Lancet, who said that actually COVID-19 shouldn't be seen as a pandemic. It should be seen as what he refers to as a syndemic, a synergistic pandemic. So it was the virus on top of the pre-existing pandemics of poverty and racism and obesity that made it so much worse. So actually, if we lived in a society where we dealt with kind of poverty, racism, obesity much better, then we'd be in a much better state to tackle the next crisis.
Just one last thought. You've mentioned avian flu, and that may be the next thing around the corner. Is it the case, do you think, that population growth, particularly perhaps in Africa, where you've already talked about that means there'll be more encroachment into areas that are currently occupied by wildlife, and that will increase the chances of disease being transmitted from animals to humans and then spreading around the world? So are we going to see more of this?
I think the likelihood is that we will. I think we're living in a golden age for microbes. Part of it is the encroachment on animal habitats, also the kind of growth in really intensive factory farming, which creates conditions that allow allow pathogens to spread through the animal population and eventually jump to humans. As I mentioned, poverty is also a massive issue. And then, of course, we have the perfect technologies for infectious diseases to spread quickly throughout the world. It's easier than ever to kind of jump on a plane and travel vast distances. If we look back to the Black Death, it took several years for Yersinia pestis to travel along the Silk Road and then via ships through the Mediterranean and throughout Europe. But history's speeded up, and you know, with COVID, it was a matter of months, and it will be the same if there's another airborne pandemic.
You've given us a lot to think about, and very grateful for so much of your time. So thank you very much for talking us through these fascinating issues.
Thank you for your interest.